Good afternoon. You know, normally we introduce the panel, but I don't think there's anybody sitting there at council table who doesn't know the three people sitting up here. So we're just going to forge right ahead, and I'm going to ask the clerk to call the case, please.
Court will now call Jerry B. Durant et al. Versus Andrew Anderson. May he support Mr. Russell R. Barton, who argue for the appellate, Mr. John H. Casey Jr., who argue for the appellate.
Mr. Barton?
May it please the court. Russell Barton on behalf of the Durant defendants and Doyle Maynard. I would like to discuss three issues with the court today. First, the lack of a material misrepresentation and justifiable reliance on the fraudulent inducement claim. Secondly, the lack of causation of harm on the defamation claim. And third, the lack of evidence of malice to defeat the qualified privilege. On the fraudulent inducement claim, it's undisputed that Mr. Anderson was an at-will employee while working both in Weatherford and in Granbury. Under the Sawyer case, an at-will employee cannot bring an action for fraud dependent on continued at-will employment. A promise that is dependent or contingent on at-will employment is not a material misrepresentation because it is illusory and it cannot be justifiably relied upon. Mr. Anderson admitted that Jerry's alleged promise was conditioned on him changing his at-will employment from Weatherford to Granbury, that he had to go down and assume management responsibility of the Granbury dealerships. Between the time of the alleged promise in early February and Mr. Anderson actually going down to Granbury and assuming management responsibility of the dealerships in mid to late February, either Jerry or Anderson could have terminated Anderson's employment. So because the alleged promise was illusory at the time it was made, there is no material misrepresentation and there's no reliance.
I know you argue that even though he did take over the management of the Granbury dealership, it was still illusory. But if he's seeking damages for not for loss of employment but for loss of ownership interest, why is it still illusory?
Because the alleged promise is still dependent or contingent upon at-will employment. In order for the promise to happen, it depended on him changing his at-will employment.
But he did do it. And in fact, in Sawyer, the Supreme Court says there are instances where it's no longer illusory. Why wouldn't this be one of those instances?
Because that is the difference between breach contract principles versus fraud principles. And that's why their reliance on the Venegas case is misplaced. Anderson could not accept the promise except by performing because it was illusory. From a breach of contract perspective, whether the contract ultimately matured into an enforceable contract, whether the promise ultimately became enforceable by virtue of Anderson's performance, that doesn't matter with respect to fraud because the misrepresentation for fraud has to be a material misrepresentation at the time it was made. Not at some other time.
If we were to accept that, you could never prevail then, and that's not what the Supreme Court said for fraudulent inducement for an at-will employee.
Well, certainly for reliance, there are instances for an at-will employee, whether it's continued at-will employment or prospective at-will employment, may be able to recover reliance damages, but not benefit of the bargain damages. Because the misrepresentation has to be material at the time it was made. For breach of contract, an offer can mature into being enforceable by performance by the other side. That's not the issue here. Breach of contract is off the table in this case. And at the time the representation was made, it was illusory. It was not material and couldn't be justifiably relied upon. Turning to the lack of causation, I'd first like to address footnote 95 of the Supreme Court's opinion regarding the source of rumors. That footnote says that this court should first consider the appellant's charge error issues, particularly whether the trial court erred in failing to require the jury to find that the appellants made specific defamatory statements in question number 12. I think what that's in reference to is the court's ruling in the Boss versus Smith case at 556 Southwest 3rd, 293. That opinion came out a couple of weeks prior to the Supreme Court's opinion in this case. And in Boss, the Supreme Court held that the plaintiff failed to link his damages to specific statements that had been made by the defendant. So here, since the trial court allowed the jury to just paraphrase what was said, instead of finding what each defendant actually said, it just creates a snowball effect to the subsequent charge questions and precludes linking damages to specific statements as required by the damages question in number 22. So, for example, in his SIR reply, Anderson argues that the jury rejected that Jerry made statements of suspicions. But we don't know that because the trial court didn't require the jury to find what the appellants actually said, what the statements actually were. But so while the trial court did err in submitting the defamation claim, that does not preclude the court from conducting a sufficiency review of the evidence on whether Jerry's alleged statements were a proximate cause of harm on this record. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court's long-held jurisprudence, the Poole case, for example, that says prior to ordering a remand, courts of appeals should first consider rendition points. The Supreme Court's opinion reaffirms the holding in Brady that to prove harm to reputation, rumors within a community are not enough. The evidence must show that people believed the statements and that plaintiff's reputation was actually affected. Anderson only relies on Mr. Hiley's testimony to prove harm to his reputation. He says on page 31 of his brief that there is circumstantial evidence that Jerry published statements to Hiley. That's just false. Mr. Hiley unequivocally testified that he did not hear any rumor from Jerry, Doyle, or anyone within the Durant organization. And there's no evidence that Mr. Hiley heard any rumor from any of the appellants. Hiley testified that the rumor he heard was that Anderson was fired for taking illegal kickbacks. And as the court previously held, the only evidence that Anderson had been fired came from Anderson himself. Hiley testified he heard a rumor a week or so after meeting with Anderson on January the 24th. But on January the 26th, Anderson filed this lawsuit alleging that he had been fired and making public his allegation that he had been accused of taking kickbacks. So under the equal inference rule, it's just as likely that any rumor that Hiley or anyone else heard resulted from Anderson's own actions. Jerry talked to four people. He and Cote had a private, closed-door meeting with Anderson on December the 28th. And then secondly, Jerry relayed his suspicions to Don Allen, Cote, and Doyle, all Durant management. Anderson doesn't claim that the statements that were made to him caused him any harm. And you can see that on the handout that they just filed with the court. He claims that the harm comes from Jerry's suspicions that he relayed to Don Allen, Cote, and Doyle. But there's no evidence that Don Allen, Cote, or Doyle repeated Jerry's statements of suspicion. Cote made other statements to Mr. Clark, but there's no evidence that Mr. Clark believed them or that they negatively affected his opinion of Anderson's reputation. Anderson claims that Doyle repeated Jerry's statements to Bermea. That's just false. Doyle talked to Bermea 2 months before Jerry talked to Doyle. There's no evidence that Bermea repeated those statements to anyone. No evidence connects Jerry's or Doyle's statements of suspicion to anyone outside of Durant management. Mr. Hiley testified. Question, I mean, you have no way to tie it back to Jerry's, do you? Answer, no. Have you talked to anyone that you know can tie it back to Jerry's? Answer, no. You know, I don't, again, I don't know anyone there. That's at volume 18, pages 248 to 249, which is not included in Mr. Anderson's handout. So, there's no evidence connecting the statements. So Anderson argues, well, Jerry's just liable for any rumor that anybody said just because he relayed his suspicions to the management people. That kind of strict liability argument would just have a chilling effect on employer investigations. It's contrary to the Randall's case and the Rinconi's case. Proximate cause is required, and that includes but for cause in fact. Anderson ignores cause in fact. There must be evidence connecting Jerry's private statements to someone outside of Durant management, and there just is none. That's the Moon case that we cite and the Reeves case. The Supreme Court holds that rumors are not enough. There's insufficient evidence of proximate cause. Turning to malice, the malice issue, there's no evidence that Jerry knew his suspicions were false. There's no evidence of a purposeful avoidance of the truth. The circumstances at the time of Jerry's statements were the wholesale policy existed to prevent kickbacks. Second, Jerry had documents that showed Anderson violated that policy. And third, Anderson lied to Jerry about where he bought the cars. Other car dealers testified it is reasonable to be suspicious and to investigate if an employee violates company policy or lies to the employer. Both of those existed here. There's no evidence that Jerry's statements of suspicion made during an investigation were made with actual malice. So the jury's finding of a qualified privilege should result in the rendition on the defamation claim. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Just because you say there is no evidence doesn't mean there is no evidence, and which brings me to the fact that, you know, I don't ordinarily do this, but getting the facts right in a hotly contested case like this is important because truth matters. And with that in mind, what I want to devote the majority of my time to this morning, or this afternoon, I'm sorry, is clearing up some of the confusion that the appellants have created with regard to the facts underlying the fraud and defamation claims, and then I'll hopefully have some time to briefly address the damages issues. In going through this recitation of some of the facts, I think I'll address most of your questions, Justice Gabriel, and also respond to many of the statements that Mr. Barton has made. I'll begin with the argument that there's legally insufficient evidence to support the fraud claim because it's based on an unenforceable promise of continued at-will employment. As you know, the Supreme Court held that the existence of an enforceable promise is supported by legally sufficient evidence. And no matter how you twist or Durant tries to twist, contort, or slant the evidence in this case, there is no fraud claim in this case in which Mr. Anderson is seeking the recovery of damages for lost employment, as there was in Sawyer. There's no testimony that Durant promised to continue to employ Mr. Anderson if he left Weatherford to manage the Granberry stores, and there's no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Anderson relied on any such promise in leaving Weatherford to do that. The only promise on which Anderson's fraud claim is based, and the only promise that the evidence shows that he relied on was Durant's promise to give him a 10% ownership interest in the two Granberry dealerships. And even assuming that the Mr. Durant's offer had some illusory component in it that involved continued at-will employment, I think you'll see from reading the Venegas case, which I believe, but for the fact that it's a breach of contract case and not a fraud case, it's virtually on all fours with this case. But under that, the court's rationale in that case, once Mr. Anderson accepted the offer, which he did shortly after it was made, it became binding and enforceable. Again, the fact that that case is a breach of contract case is really immaterial. The question is whether the offer was accepted and became binding and enforceable, and it did. But putting those arguments aside, I'm not sure this issue is before the court. If you look under tab B1 of your oral argument handout, those are excerpts from Mr. Durant's briefing in the Supreme Court where he raised this issue. We, of course, anticipated that he would, and we addressed it in our petitioner's brief on the merits. So this issue that you're being asked to decide was squarely before the Supreme Court. In fact, the court referred to Anderson's at-will employment twice in its opinion, and it expressly disposed of Mr. Anderson's lost income damages award based on the fact that he was employed on an at-will basis. So given that holding, given what is obviously a detailed analysis of the evidence supporting the fraud claim, specifically with respect to the enforceability of the promise underlying that claim, it's inconceivable to me that the Supreme Court would have overlooked this legal sufficiency argument in arriving at its decision that there's legally sufficient evidence to support an enforceable promise. And what I believe the court was referring to in footnote 101 of its opinion, where it identified some of the issues it was remanding, are the issues raised under tab B2, which were presented to this court on the first submission, but were not raised in the Supreme Court. But regardless, if this court were to hold that the promise underlying the fraud claim is unenforceable because it's illusory, that would not only be contrary to the record, it'd be inconsistent, I believe, with the Supreme Court's holding. Very briefly, with respect to Mr. Durant's factual sufficiency complaints on this enforceability of the agreement, if you'd compare his arguments here under that he labels factual sufficiency with the legal sufficiency arguments he made in the Supreme Court, you'd see they're virtually identical. In essence, what they are saying here is that because there's a conflict in the evidence on the terms of the oral agreement, that the evidence supporting the verdict is somehow too weak. And of course, as your honors know, that's a ridiculous argument. Otherwise, no contested case would ever survive factual sufficiency review. And they actually give no reason why the court should give greater weight to Mr. Durant's version of the facts on this than the facts that the jury found, the evidence that the jury found supported their finding. But the worst thing about their argument is that many of the so-called facts that they say are contrary to the verdict are actually contrary to the record. For example, the Christmas bonus. Durant has maintained throughout this appeal from the very beginning that the $75,000 payment that he gave Anderson in Christmas of 2011 was a payment in lieu of the ownership agreement. And Anderson has always maintained, no, it's a Christmas bonus. Well, Durant, in the briefs before this court on remand, continues to take that position but fails to point out to the court that Mr. Durant himself said, quote, it's a damn bonus. And he showed it in his books under Plaintiff's Exhibit 129 as part of his bonus program for 2011. Durant insists that the jury's finding that he promised Anderson an immediate ownership interest in the Toyota dealership is outweighed and contrary to the evidence that it was contingent on Toyota's approval of splitting the Granberry store from the Weatherford franchise. If you look under tab A, you'll see some exhibits that I think put the lie to that theory. It's part of a brochure prepared by the Durant organization and a press release announcing in real time that Anderson is a partner, principal operator of both Granberry dealerships. There's a picture there with Mr. Durant, Mr. Anderson, and Mr. Don Allen standing in front of the Toyota store. Pictures don't lie. Of course, the announcement was false because the evidence shows and the jury found that Mr. Durant never intended to give Mr. Anderson an ownership interest in the stores. But I think that these exhibits at least show that Durant's version of the promise is overwhelmingly outweighed by the evidence in this case. Durant alleges that Andrew, quote, admitted that he was babysitting the Toyota store so that Kevin Reese could take it over. And the testimony that they cite in support of that is Mr. Reeves's testimony. It's not Mr. Anderson's testimony. He never admitted to any such thing. But these are the types of things that you would not pick up without a robust review of the record. The defamation facts are equally inaccurate, at least Durant's version of them are.
So where is the evidence that Hiley heard these rumors and that he could attribute that to Durant or anyone in the management group?
Well, Your Honor, Hiley did not say that he heard it from Durant. But the jury was charged, the jury was asked two questions, whether Durant negligently published a statement and whether that's if so, whether that statement or that accusation approximately caused harm to Mr. Anderson or approximately caused damages to him. And which was defined in the court's charge as damages that were reasonably foreseeable. The Supreme Court quoted much of Mr. Hiley's testimony.
They did, but they never went beyond that was a scintilla of evidence. You get past legal sufficiency. Now you go back and look at factual sufficiency. So I realize they quoted it, but I'm asking you to meet the level of factual sufficiency. Where is your evidence that these damages from Hiley knowing this can be attributed to Durant?
Okay, Your Honor, again, reasonable foreseeability is what the evidence had to show, that Mr. Durant could reasonably foresee that the statement that he made to three men in his organization on four different occasions without ever making any effort to ensure that information and those conversations would be confidential. There's no serious dispute here that Mr. Anderson could reasonably foresee that his statements, no matter how you characterize them, could get out into the within his organization outside of it. I mean, he himself said word travels fast in the car industry, and he acknowledged that it would harm Mr. Anderson if it did.
So I don't believe
we have to have direct evidence that Anderson, that would connect Anderson's kickback accusation to Hiley. We just have to show that it was reasonably foreseeable that when Mr. Anderson published it as many times as he did to as many people as he did, that it would get out and it would harm Mr. Anderson.
And you say as many people as he did and as many times as he did. The evidence, and I'm not saying that's not many.
Sure.
I'm just trying to get this clear. The evidence is you agree that he told it to three people in his organization.
Correct.
Okay.
At least that's what the evidence shows. And the evidence also shows that one of those persons that he communicated this statement to also shared it with someone outside the Durant organization. And that was Mark Clark. And the excerpts of his testimony where he testifies to this is under tab E. And I would also refer the court to volume 23 of the reporter's record, where Durant testifies at length about the people that he told about his so-called kickback suspicion to and the circumstances surrounding that. And we've provided the court with a chart under tab D, which identifies all of the people in this world of listeners, world of persons who were in the car industry and could have heard this accusation. It identifies them. Durant himself admitted that he was a source of the rumor, and the evidence shows that it was repeated, and he reasonably foresaw that it would be. Bottom line is, this kickback rumor did not just fall out of the sky.
Well, but could it have come from Mr. Anderson himself? I mean, that's certainly their position.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I thought you asked me if it could come from Mr. Durant himself, and he admitted that it did.
Mr. Anderson himself.
Mr. Anderson shared it with two or three close personal acquaintances of him. His one was Mr. Jake DeCoker, who was allegedly, according to Durant, complicit with this false kickback lie. And then with Mr. Thompson, he was seeking Mr. Thompson's advice, but there's absolutely no evidence that those persons repeated the lie to anybody else in this world of persons on the chart that we've provided.
Just briefly, what's your response to his challenge to the lack of specificity in question 12?
Well, Your Honor, as far back as I think 1906, the Supreme Court has held that all you have to have when there's a slander case, which is an oral publication, is a substantial agreement between the evidence and the statement. And that's what we have here. no matter whether you take Mr. Durant's version or Mr. Anderson's version, it involved an accusation that Anderson was taking kickbacks. The evidence is clear on that.
I have another question I want to ask you, and we'll give some additional time to Mr. Barton. The Supreme Court, in their opinion, highly suggests, or at least the way I read it, they suggest that the damages awards for the past mental anguish and past defamation are excessive. They're pretty, you know, it's not even very subtle that they say that. Then they go on to say that we have to look at that, we have to review that, and perhaps we could suggest a remittiture or a new trial, which I know everybody would just love to have. I say that in jest.
Yeah. We'll ask Mr. Connor about that.
What is your response, or how do you feel about that?
Okay.
How do you think we should look at that?
You know, Your Honor, we briefed that at length. I'm not sure I can add much more to what we said in our briefs, other than this. I would just ask that the court keep in mind the personal nature of these type of damages. They're not subject to mathematical calculation. The only standard is reasonableness, and as long as it's supported by the evidence. And to more specifically answer your question, Justice Gabriel, I've really struggled with this. I know this is going to be probably the hardest part of this case that you're going to have to decide. And my answer to your question would be perhaps the best way for you to arrive at a right decision on this would be put yourself in Mr. Anderson's shoes. Or better yet, put yourself in Judge Bentley's shoes. You know, the Bentley case was very similar in that the evidence in that case showed that an accusation that a judge takes a bribe is the worst thing you could say about a judge. Well, that's what the testimony here was. The worst thing you could say about Mr. Anderson in his industry was that he was taking kickbacks. So imagine that rumor circulating in the second district. Imagine that it becomes part of a whisper campaign when you're up for re-election. And further, imagine that perhaps you lose that election because of that vicious rumor that was started by one of your opponents. I mean, how would that affect you? How would it affect your family? How would it affect your mental state of mind? How would it affect...
But don't we just have to look at the evidence in the record?
And we have this evidence in the record, and what I'm saying is, if you put yourself in Mr. Anderson's shoes, and by analogy, imagine yourself as a judge in his shoes, and the worst thing being said about you, how would that affect you? And again, the record is replete with evidence that Mr. Anderson was terribly damaged in terms of his mental anguish. I don't have time to repeat all of the testimony on that. That his reputation was damaged, that he couldn't get a job for 9 months, he was paranoid, afraid to get out of the house. It affected his family. So I'm just asking you, put yourself in his shoes, in your position. That's the only way I know that you can come up with the right decision on that, which I have all the confidence in the world that you will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with the Supreme Court's opinion, where they talk about the unaddressed issues at the court below, and they say those are back on the table for this court to consider. Footnote 101, the unaddressed issues include sufficiency of the evidence to support the jury's findings of a material misrepresentation and detrimental reliance on the fraudulent inducement claim. That takes care of that argument by the appellants. Mr. Anderson admitted that Jerry's promise was conditioned on him changing his at-will employment from Weatherford to Granbury for fraudulent misrepresentation. The misrepresentation must be material at the time it's made under Sawyer because the promise was dependent, contingent on at-will employment. There's no fraud claim. Regarding causation, it is not reasonably foreseeable that privileged statements between management in an employment investigation will be repeated outside of the organization. That's the Frakes case that we've cited and the Earhart case that we've cited. Anderson points to no evidence that Don Allen, Cote, or Doyle had repeated privileged communications from an investigation to others in the past. It is not accurate to say that it was reasonably foreseeable that any statements that get made within an investigation, that just creates strict liability if there's rumors later on that nobody
knows. Is your argument it wasn't reasonably foreseeable, or that but-for causation is lacking here?
Both. There is an absence of cause in fact, because there is no evidence that connects Jerry's or Doyle's statements to anyone. Reasonable foreseeability is lacking under the Frakes case and the Earhart case. This strict liability standard that Anderson argues is just not the law. Proximate cause is the law. And on their chart, other than Hiley testified he didn't hear about it from anybody at the Durant organization. Jerry, Doyle, Don, he didn't hear it from anybody. Couldn't tie it back to him. Any of the other people on this chart that Anderson argues heard the rumor, there's no evidence that any of those persons believed it or that it negatively affected their view of Anderson's reputation. The Supreme Court says rumors are not enough. Anderson's wanting to tell the court that rumors is all that matters. That's not the law. Very briefly on the malice issue, the jury charge required that whatever statement it was that was found in question number 12, we don't know what it is, but whatever it was, be the statement that proximately caused the harm and be the statement that was made with malice. And that's the problem with Anderson's argument. Anderson relies on Jerry's statement to Anderson for malice, but that is not the statement that Anderson claims was the proximate cause of harm. It's smoke and mirrors. There is no evidence of malice. We would ask that the court reverse and render.
Let me ask you one other question.
Yes.
Justice Gabriel brought up the issues of these non-pecuniary damages, and I may have been tired by the time I got to this point in your brief, but the Supreme Court tells us we're supposed to conduct meaningful reviews of these non-pecuniary damages, but don't bother to tell us how to do it. You mostly, I think, rely on this comparison between the facts of this case and the facts of other cases with lower damage awards. But is there any argument you can give us about actually conducting a factual sufficiency review that would show that these awards are excessive?
Absolutely. Just on reputation. Anderson was not able to find a job for 9 months. But he testified he didn't know why. He went on interviews. We know from the prior opinion. Immediately, he was going out on interviews. There's no evidence that nobody hired him for 9 months because he had a bad reputation. There's no evidence. Will Churchill at Frank Kent hired Anderson after 9 months. What Anderson is wanting the court to believe is that Will Churchill would hire him in a management position end up promoting him to a higher management position, but somehow would not have hired him for some other management position because he had a bad reputation. It doesn't make sense. The evidence is factually insufficient that his reputation was actually harmed on mental anguish. To button it up on reputation, to the extent that there is sufficient evidence of harm to reputation, because of all those factors, we think that if there's a remittiture, that any resulting award should be minimal. His harm was minimal. He is asking the court to affirm a $400,000 award for 9 months of not being able to get a job when he has no idea why he was not able to get a job. That's just not right. On mental anguish, he was immediately going out on interviews. He did not...
I've got it. I asked you to open any question right there at the end.
Well, so. Very, very well. We would ask that the court reverse and render, or in the alternative, reverse and remand on both liability and damages. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted.